We spent much of our time in the train playing piquet and ecarte, and recognized each other as fairish sharps. But neither of us was able to take much interest in the game. I was too inwardly nervous, and he was too busy keeping an eye on me. He was one of these extraordinary folk who can be on the hair trigger of action for days and nights on end. Well, not once in that journey was there a decent chance to take him unawares. Not that I'd have dared to try if there had been. I'd got a healthy respect for young Rudy by now, and didn't doubt that he'd shoot me without the slightest hesitation and take his chance on the consequences. So we came to Berlin on a night of bitter snow and wind, and there was another coach at the station to whirl us away through the busy lamp-lit streets. Even with our fur-collared coats and rugs and hot bricks, it was damnably chilly in that coach after the warmth of the train, and I wasn't cheered by the fact that our journey was obviously not going to be a short one. That much was clear from the fact that we had a couple of hampers of food with us, and a basket of bottles as well. It lasted another 3 days, what with snow-choked roads and the coach shedding a wheel, and damned uncomfortable it was. I guessed we were travelling west at about 20 miles a day, but beyond that there was nothing to be learned from the dreary German landscape. The snow stuck to the windows, and the coach was like an ice house. I cursed and grumbled a good deal, but Starnberg sat patiently in his corner, huddled in his greatcoat, whistling softly through his teeth. His observations were either insolently cheerful or caustic, and I couldn't decide which I disliked more. It was towards evening on the third day that I awoke from a doze to find Rudy with the window down, peering out into the dusk. The snow had stopped for the moment, but there was a keen wind whistling into the coach, and I was about to tell him brusquely to shut the window before we froze, when he pulled his head in and said, "Journey's end. Thank God, now for some decent food at last and a proper bed." I leaned forward to look out, and I've seen cheerier prospects. We were rolling slowly up a long avenue of trees toward a huge, bleak house, half mansion, half castle. In the fading light, with the wintry sky behind it, it looked in silhouette like the setting for some gothic novel, all towers and spires and rugged stonework. There were lights in some of the windows, and a great lantern shone yellow above the pointed archway of its main door, but they served only to exaggerate the ancient gloom of the place. "Child flashy to the dark tower came," thinks I, and tried not to imagine what lay within. It proved to be a match for the exterior. We were shown into an immense stone-flagged hall, hung round with faded tapestries and a few old trophies of arms and the chase. There were archways without doors leading out of it, and in keeping with the general air of medieval ghastliness, there were even torches burning in brackets on the walls. The place felt like a tomb, and the ancient butler who received us would have made an excellent grave-digger. But what daunted me most of all was the presence in the hall of a strapping trio of fellows, all of military cut, who welcomed Rudy and weighed me up with cold professional eyes. One was a massive, close-cropped, typical Prussian, whose fleshy face was wheeled with a great sabre-cut from brow to chin. The second was a tall, supple, sinister gentleman, with sleek black hair and a vulpine smile. The third was stocky and stout, balding and ugly. All were in undress uniforms, and as tough-looking a set of customers as you could wish for. My spirits sank even farther as I realized that with this crew on hand, my chances of escape had dwindled out of sight.